You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
My name is Chris Coyne, and I'm the Associate Director of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And today I'm speaking with Professor Amy Crockett, who is a senior lecturer in the Department of Economics at Vanderbilt University and a graduate of our PhD program in economics at George Mason and a former Hayek Fellow. So, Amy, it's wonderful to speak with you and welcome back virtually.
Yes, thank you. Good to be back.
We are talking about your paper, Addressing Peace in Undergraduate Economics Textbooks, which is part of our symposium on Kenneth Bowling that we're putting together in the Review of Austrian Economics. And I want to start broadly by asking you to tell our listeners a bit about what your paper is about in the broadest sense and what motivated you to write it.
Yes, in the broadest sense, the title kind of captures the paper. It's thinking about how economics addresses peace and the issues of peace in undergraduate textbooks. And that is in its broadest sense. But where the motivation came from, partially, of course, is because of the Bowling Symposium, so that's part of it. But I would actually say, I have to acknowledge you here as one of the catalysts for this paper. We were discussing some ideas behind education and economics of education, and you shared a Kenneth Bowling quote with me, which I'm sure we'll get to later in more detail, but it was about, Kenneth Bowling says, you know, Ford and General Motors are in huge competition with one another, but the Ford president, like if he ever suggested burning down the General Motors factory, of course, like the board would never let that happen. And people would just like laugh at him because that's just like such an unserious suggestion. And that really like opened my eyes to this idea of thinking about the economy just like in a different light. Like I know importance of property rights. I know prices matter. I know profit and loss, like they all like contribute to this well-functioning economy and they all help contribute to cooperation. But I'd never thought about it in the sense of like underlying peace and like what goes on below those, all those like property rights and all this stuff. So I started looking at the economy and the world like that. And all of a sudden you start seeing like, okay, well, McDonald's and Burger King, like they're at odds with one another. Like they want the same consumers. They want the same customers. They have conflict. But yet, what do? They run different promotions. They have different seasonal items. They do these like product differentiation. And at no point are they like burning each other down. Or like I think about like Uber and Lyft. About 10 years ago, Lyft went really hard on a campaign about how much better they treat their drivers than Uber. And the whole goal was like differentiate their treatment of their driver and their product versus Uber. Like they never went around slashing tires. And so all of a sudden I start seeing these examples everywhere. And same thing with like, there's two famous companies, Cafe Rio and Costa Vida, that they had this like intellectual theft that they claim occurs. And again, what do? They do a lawsuit, they do private mediation, they find a solution. And so the long-winded way of saying like, this is incredibly important and such an underlying point that I started thinking, well, all right, if this is so important, where do textbooks actually talk about this? What are they actually saying?
Yeah, that's great. Cause then, you're right that when we just step back and think about it, so much of what we talk about as economists in our just even intro level, let alone more advanced classes, take peace as number one, a background condition. So there has to be some semblance of peace, for instance, to trade in the first place. But then on top of it, as you noted through your various examples, markets actually foster peace by providing a means of navigating conflicting interests often and competing interests, but not resorting to violence to navigate them. And so you have peace kind of ubiquitous throughout the process on the front end, and then actually through economic interactions as well. So then I want to ask you to talk a little bit about economic education itself and help us understand why economic education, so the process of educating students or the public, is important for understanding and fostering the conditions for peace and finding peaceful solutions to these instances of conflicting interests.
Right. Economic education, any education at all, gives students a view of what's possible, what's out there, what are the possibilities. And this is not to say that they can't figure things out on their own. Like, if you say that only what they learn in school is what they can do, then of course no entrepreneurship would be, you know, wouldn't be a thing. So, but it does lay the foundation for students understanding how the market works, how it contributes to peace, and what opportunity and role they play in that process. And they actually play a huge role. One of the things that the paper talks about, and I think, you know, gets discussed in a lot of your work and in Bolding, is that yes, there's top-down peace, but that each one of us contribute to peace and each one of us has this role to play in peace. And if you don't give students a view that they matter and that something that they do is going to contribute, I think that you stunt their growth and you stunt their ability to play an important role in current and future peacemaking and peace building. Now, if you go to Bolding, if you want me to talk about that for a second. So Bolding has these three ways that he thinks, and I agree with him, how education can foster this idea of peace. And his three things, and I'll try to break them down, but he talks about image, our self-image, and he says the role of statistics, which is, I think, a fun one and interesting one. And then the third one he says is the policy fosters or can not foster peace. So when he talks about image, he's talking about the way that we perceive ourselves and our nation, but also in what we perceive as like possible in our actions. Like, again, so the example of like, you know, Ford would never burn down General Motors because it doesn't even enter their mind. It's not appropriate. So they have this image of how they should act and behave. And you have that similar image of your nation state. And how do we get that image? A part of it is through education. And so a longstanding example that hopefully is still true today, but he uses is like United States and the United Kingdom. We were such close allies that at no point do we even think that they're going to attack us. And again, so the role of education is putting this into our mindset of like, well, what actions are appropriate and what are inappropriate? The other place is, the second thing is statistics. And this is where I think it's super fascinating. And let me just give an example of where it maybe breaks down to explain what he's talking about here. There's often a view that World War II got us out of the Depression. That like by going to war, we got ourselves out of the Depression or the United States or other countries, right? And so he says, well, actually, statistics are really, really important because they inform politicians and voters and citizens of what, like the feedback loop. They kind of tell us what's happening. And so if we tell all the citizens and we say, like, look at the numbers, war gets us out of, you know, economic hardships, then that's maybe how we'll vote or view in the future. And so he talks about, well, look, these statistics can then view, they shape how we view policy. And so I think the example with the Great Depression is really, really great because you see, of course, we get out of the war and we still grow and we're doing fine. And I think it also mistakes, of course, the connection that war destroys. War is incredibly terrible for everyone that's involved. It also diverts resources. Robert Higgs actually does a paper where he says, like, well, actually, look, 10 million of the 16 million employed people, 16 million are employed as soldiers. 10 million of them are conscripted. They don't even necessarily want to be there. So I don't know that we're saying, like, these 16 million people that are working in the military are thriving and doing really well. It's also not building up future economic growth. And so what you have happen is we have a generation maybe that thinks, hey, war got us out of the Great Depression, when in reality, that's not actually what happened. And so economic statistics can dispel some of those myths and break some of those links that aren't necessarily true. And then the last thing, of course, he talks about is that economic policy can impact the cultures of peace domestically and internationally. And actually, it's funny because this quote, when I wrote this paper and was reading this quote, I was like, I feel like we've kind of figured this out. And so Bolding actually says, he says, quote, before the Second World War, it may have been true that national economic policies, which were designed to export unemployment through tariffs and restrictions on imports, may have served to increase international conflict and lead to the deterioration of the international system, unquote. And so he talks about there is this view that like we need to protect ourselves, we need to export unemployment, right? Which then, of course, fosters negative feelings across country. And then he goes on to say, like, look, over time, actually, we realize that we can export employment through cooperation and specialization. And this is the part where I was like, wow, this really is coming back because now these are conversations that are in the media every day, I think now, with this idea of like tariffs, protectionism, how do we have employment here and elsewhere? And so policies that we create in the government and in society impact the peace that's around. So hopefully that was a long answer, but I tried to get a couple.
No, it's great. And I appreciate it. And that I'm going to come back to as my final question, some concrete examples of, or ask you to think or tell us about some concrete ways this can be included. And you've touched upon one already, which is, as you said, the contemporary policy landscape is one that fits very nicely with that. Just for listeners who are interested in Amy's point in her second category of statistics, where she mentioned World War II and the economic prosperity in Robert Higgs, the name of the paper by Robert Higgs is Wartime Prosperity, a Reassessment of the U.S. Economy in the 1940s, which was published in the Journal of Economic History in the early 1990s for anyone that wants to read that or do further exploration of that topic. But I want to switch because after laying out kind of these foundations in your paper, you engage in this study of actual textbooks. You look at a variety of undergraduate textbooks. And so I wanted to ask you to tell us a bit about your methodological approach for exploring how economists as teachers either engage or fail to engage the topic of peace in their teaching through a study of a sample of textbooks. So which textbooks did you focus on? How did you decide on that sample? And how did you just go about this exercise that you carry out in the paper?
Yes, so I focus on four specific texts: Introductory Micro, Introductory Macro, Development Economics, and International Economics. And so I found as many textbooks as I could. It's sometimes with paywalls and different things, it was kind of difficult to get. So I just did a small sample of each of them. And so I had about 6 micro, about 5 macro, and then 10 each of development and international textbooks. So intro, micro, and macro are typically required, obviously, of every econ major, but they're often required of like business majors, maybe international, like policy majors, government majors, these kinds of majors. So they have a wide variety of students are taking these introductory classes. So I thought, look, this gets us to understand kind of what the general average student is taking. Then development and international is typically most often taken by upper level economics majors or maybe like international policy majors, maybe a government major. But those I think are most, think about like development and international, maybe most getting at these ideas of peace cross country, within country. And so that's kind of the reason for those kind of 4 categories. Now, the interesting thing is within it, I kind of did 2 different things. One, I searched for like a keywords and concepts to get me at where is it even addressed? And it might be addressed somewhere that I'm not even thinking of. And then the other was I looked at specific topics in each of the textbooks and how those were addressed. So the words and concepts I looked at were peace, conflict, violence, war, defense, and security. And so the reasoning behind that is you've got the positive, like peace, and then all the negatives, like look for all the conflict, war, those kinds of things. And again, so the idea was, if I'm missing a place that this gets talked about, and in fact, one place I didn't even think of was in a microeconomics textbook, they talk about labor unions and like large conflicts between labor unions and employers, but was not on my mind as something to like would be addressed. So this was a good place for me to like see where it's being talked about. So the topics I thought about were collective action problems, externalities, and public goods provisions. Now, the reasoning for that is, of course, there's potential for conflict in all of the market, all of society, there's always potential for conflict. But I think of these 3 as like necessarily having conflicting desires, like a public good provision. It's necessarily like we build the park that I wanted or we build, the community center that you wanted. And it necessarily has to like make one of us unhappy. There can't really be and maybe potentially this in-between solution. Same thing with externalities. I want to be polluting. I want to do whatever. And it necessarily is conflicting with you. So these things where they're necessarily conflictual. And also the idea of the collective nature of them, I think, makes them very interesting. And I think it gives you a chance to look at, are these presented as necessarily needing top-down solutions, or could we potentially have these bottom-up solutions where individuals find solutions and individuals find peaceful resolution? So those were the kind of the main places I looked and the topics I was looking at.
And then what was the outcome of this? If you were to summarize the findings, I know you looked at a lot of textbooks. You don't have to go through each one, but give us a sense. Were these topics prevalent? Were they rare? What did you find?
Yeah, so micro, introductory micro kind of makes sense. Pretty much not discussed at all. The topics of obviously collective action, externalities, those are all discussed, but they are mostly discussed in a top-down approach. The government comes in, a Pigouvian tax, something like that. The macro textbooks actually almost all discuss conflict and war and defense. And it was all in context of government spending and impact on government spending on the economy. There was some discussion about potentially a war on prices and how conflict influences prices. And again, but nothing necessarily in context of like how it impacts markets or how markets benefit from peace. So that's kind of the micro and macro, maybe the less exciting, which kind of makes sense. They have to cover such a broad set of topics. But development was kind of interesting because development actually, 80% of the textbooks I looked at actually addressed war and conflict. And they actually, a lot of them discussed the impact of war. So before we get to peace, it was just like, war is destroying. It hurts standard of living. It hurts, obviously, like the cost of conflict on life, on destruction of property, on all of these things. It hurts building up industry. It decreases the amount of outside investment that comes into your country. Like all of these negative aspects are very prevalent in development textbooks. But only about two textbooks went through and thought more about like, what are potential solutions? Like, what do we do? And they kind of broke them down. I was pretty impressed kind of thinking about how we've been thinking about this. They broke it down into larger scale, long-term solutions, which are like a larger institutional change or a change in how the country is run in itself. And then more small scale, shorter term solutions where you have local communities or organizations that come together to create kind of changes in the society and changes in maybe not necessarily the war itself, but how do I make my neighborhood less conflictual? How do I have less war in my neighborhood or less things in my neighborhood? So I thought that that was very interesting because I thought it very much went along the lines of like things that we've been thinking about and talking about, that these are both top-down and bottom-up solutions. And so I was actually pretty impressed that a couple of these actually did end up talking about this. But a lot end up spending a lot of time talking about like non-governmental organizations, like NGOs. And I think those are very, very important and play a good role. But I do think it's like, you know, stunting a little bit to think that we can only find solutions in government or in NGOs. And I think it's good that those two like talked about more community-based. And then, yeah, international textbooks, I'll skip to the kind of the main takeaway there is a lot was spent on trade. And I think that that is one place that, yeah, trade can kind of cut two ways. With trade, it increases cooperation with one another. It increases wealth between two countries. But on the flip side, and as we've seen kind of in different historical examples and potentially now, the trade can also, it can be used as a tool of conflict or of as a way to like protect yourself, which then comes across as like kind of necessarily conflictual with others. So international textbooks talk a lot about trade as their way of thinking about peace.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And that those few development books you highlighted that really kind of get into the nuance of violence and war, that serves as a nice segue to this final question, which I want to ask you as someone who is a very effective economic educator who thinks about these issues. What do you see as potential opportunities for economic education to fill this gap? Because while there are a few textbooks that kind of go into more detail, as you pointed out, there's very few, and it's understandable, as you put it quite nicely. There's a lot of material to cover, especially in those core classes. And so it's understandable, but that doesn't mean there's not an opportunity to perhaps link in some of these issues related to peace and peacemaking with broader economic education. And so any final thoughts on how listeners who are either educators themselves or who work with educators might begin to think about some opportunities?
Yes, I think this first isn't a huge lift. I think just pointing out that with peace being in the market, you're allowing just markets themselves by trading, by selling things to one another, by allowing cooperation, allowing me to hire another worker, allowing me to do all these things. I think that just in how the market works, it can create a culture of peace because it's about cooperation. Like I have to provide something to you that you would actually like. I have to figure out what you want. I have to think about you to some extent. So I think at the most basic, just how does the market function and how does that allow cultures of peace to prevail? I think a couple others I've kind of already mentioned. And so I wish I had like really great examples, but I think breaking the link between like war and development, it's funny because I think in some contexts, it's very obvious that war does not provide growth. But yet in other contexts, we often teach it as providing growth. Or at least like military spending is providing growth. So it's just like a very interesting thing because I think if you bring up a war to students, they're like, oh, that was so terrible. But then as soon as you bring up like the Great Depression or something like that, or like right now, like military spending, anything it is, there's sometimes like this disconnect, I think. So that's another one. The other thing is I think empowering students to realize that they have a power to contribute. And I think if you don't want, I would love to read this like Eleanor Ostrom quote that I like kind of end my paper with. I think it's powerful. And I know it's Eleanor Ostrom like won the Nobel Prize, did all this work with this idea of communities finding solutions that it like each of us are empowered. And so I'll try to just skip to the point here. She says, for those who wish the 21st century to be one of peace, we need to translate our research findings on collective action into material written for high school and undergraduate students. All too many of our textbooks focus exclusively on leaders and worse, only national level leaders. students completing an introductory course on American government or political science more generally will not learn that they play an essential role in sustaining democracy. Citizen participation is presented as contacting leaders, organizing interest groups and parties, and voting. That citizens need additional skills and knowledge to resolve the social dilemmas they face is left unaddressed. The moral decisions are not discussed. We are producing generations of cynical citizens with little trust in one another, much less in their governments. Given the central role of trust in solving social dilemmas, we may be creating the very conditions that undermine our own democratic ways of life. It is ordinary persons and citizens who craft and sustain the workability of the institutions of everyday life. We owe an obligation to the next generation to carry forward the best of our knowledge about how individuals solve the multiplicity of social dilemmas, large and small, that they face.
Yeah, and that's wonderful because that really highlights both the importance of these topics, but also the importance of education and educators, people doing the educating, to introduce students to these topics and hopefully, you know, introduce them as part of an analytical toolkit to both, as you put it earlier, number one, make clear to students that these issues exist and are out there and are within the realm of choice, but also how economic activity, but then even for non-economists, how, as Eleanor Ostrom is talking about, people as citizens, political institutions are either peace enhancing or preventing or harming peace and fostering violence. The paper is titled Addressing Peace in Undergraduate Economics Textbooks. The author is Professor Amy Crockett. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Yes, thank you so much, Chris.
Today, I am joined by my colleague, Dr. Erwin Decker, who is a senior fellow with the Hayek Program. Erwin, thank you for speaking with me today.
Always great talking, Chris.
We are here to discuss Erwin's paper, Kenneth Balding and James Buchanan on the Public Function of Economics, which is part of a special issue that we are putting together in the Review of Austrian Economics on Kenneth Balding's work, on his life, and on the contemporary relevance of his work. And one of the things I appreciate very much about this paper is it gets at a certain aspect of Balding's approach to economics, but also makes these connections with James Buchanan as well. And so, Erwin, let's get into it. And let me ask you to begin by providing our listeners with a general overview of the core thesis of your paper.
So the core thesis of the paper is that if we read these thinkers, Kenneth Balding and James Buchanan, alongside each other, we understand each better. That is the core premise of the argument. And I take two elements from those thinkers. The first is Balding, and Balding has a notion of the image. He uses this notion quite often to talk about science, but it can be applied much more broadly. The image is essentially a sort of perspective on the world that human beings use to navigate their world, not merely in terms of what is what, but also what is possible and what is good or what is bad. And he calls it semi-rational, so he's not at all dismissive of it. He thinks it's a very important tool in sort of coping with the world. There are private elements to it, so it will be shaped in part by our own personal experiences, but quite a bit of it is public, or at least shared within communities. So if you think about, you know, a particular community having a particular outlook on the world, then that would be part of the image, and individuals will have individual quirks to that image, but quite a lot of it will be shared. And so then he goes on to investigate where that image comes from, right? And obviously, historically, it will have been shaped by religion. It will have been shaped by, I don't know, stories about nationalism or national histories. It will be shaped also in part by science, because part of the stories that modern people, he suggests, tell about themselves are inspired by science. So it will include something about human evolution, like we derive from the apes or the primates ultimately. So that's an important part in which science has contributed to the image that human beings have of themselves and their place in the world. Right? You can also think even of major natural science discoveries, like being the center of the universe or not so much center of the universe. And so he also starts applying this to economics. So how does economics contribute to man's self-understanding of its place in the world? And I think that is where it gets really interesting and where there's an interesting overlap with Buchanan, because Buchanan, I think, is also uniquely concerned with how science and economics in particular, but for him, economics is a fairly broad science that includes, I think, often parts of political science at the very least, shapes our own understanding of the world. And he's very worried that modern science here, or modern economics here, is creating a misguided perspective, because it suggests somehow implicitly that the major way in which human beings govern is through the state. And Buchanan says, no, we primarily govern or navigate the world through interpersonal relationships. And so, because interpersonal relationships are so important, he is looking for us for an economics that starts from interpersonal relationships rather than from an assumption that says, well, there's a group, we call them the state, and they govern over the others. So the primary purpose of economics is essentially to tell what set of rules or policies these people that govern over us should use to govern us. And this major reorientation, and that is, I think, where the two thinkers really complement each other. Gannon says, well, it's really important that we don't make this mistake of assuming that there's governing over. So we have to alter this image somehow. And so they see a public role to economics in shaping the image, or possibly also corrupting the image, right? And this brings up difficult moral questions, and I'm sure we're going to talk a bit more about that, but obviously it requires a notion of what you consider to be a corrupting influence on the image, or what you consider to be an improving notion of the image. But since both believe, both Boulding and Buchanan believe, that economists contribute to this image, they say we almost cannot escape moral questions in our science, because whatever we're going to do, we're going to end up contributing to this image. So if we understand that, then we might as well do it in the best way possible.
Yeah, that's great introduction. Thank you. And to build on that a little more, you discuss in the paper how both Boulding and Buchanan emphasize this issue of the science of exchange. And you touched upon this in your introductory remarks, but I want to delve into it a little more. So there's this science of exchange, and there's a moral foundation to it. As you mentioned, Buchanan emphasized this issue of human relationships from kind of the ground up in politics and in economics and so on. Boulding, you talk about this element of Boulding as well, emphasize this idea of the integrative system. You know, he called it the hug in Three Faces of Power. And in some cases, he took very liberal scholars. So people, I remember in one instance, Milton Friedman, he says, great stuff, but it downplays the integrative aspects and focuses on the exchange aspects. And so there is this fascinating framing from Boulding where exchange and these integrative relationships are connected. But what I wanted to ask you to start, and you can take this in whatever direction you want, is to tell us how these two thinkers, Buchanan and Boulding, paralleled one another when we think about the science of exchange from a moral perspective, but also how these thinkers might have diverged in some areas.
So that we're completely on the same page, right? Boulding distinguishes between three types of relationships, two of which I think he considers generally good, or maybe one exceptionally good, that is the hug or the integrative relationship. Then there is the exchange, in which there's not necessarily a whole lot of overlap or integration feasible, but there is mutual benefit. So both parties end up better off than they were beforehand. So maybe it doesn't necessarily contribute to the strong integration and building of communities, but it certainly helps to foster peaceful relationships, right? Because this is an underlying theme, I think, in both thinkers. And then there's type of relationships that are harmful, that you can call them aggression, predation, conflict, even war. And so there are type of relationships that they both feel humans are very capable of, all three of them, right? It's not that empirically we can say, well, human beings are really this or really that, but rather we have the capacity to engage in all these three relationships. And so here the intermediate role of the image is that we may be able to say, well, you think of a lot of this as a conflictual relationship, but in fact, if you look at it from this other way, we can turn it into an exchange relationship or an integrative relationship. So that's in part what they do. Now, you also asked where they differ, right? And I think where they differ is a sort of interesting aspect of how they think about these three relationships. I think they both agree that the conflict relationship is to be avoided as much as possible. I think there's interesting questions to ask how much they feel they are fundamental to human history. I don't have very strong views, but I think they would differ a little bit on that. I think Buchanan differs a bit from Balding in considering exchange relationships, because I think Buchanan really has a very positive view of exchange relationships and is even willing to consider that integrative relationships occasionally might go awry or might lead to their bad consequences. This is something I did not discuss in the paper, and it's already in its final version, but some people have given me feedback after that fact and said, you should have done something with the Samaritan's Dilemma. And the Samaritan's Dilemma is one famous instance in which Buchanan engages in what for Balding is clearly an integrative relationship, one person helping another. And does that lead to necessarily to positive outcomes? Now, Balding there, I think, is much more he's a convinced Quaker, but he much more holds the religious aspect that if you pursue individual virtue or from good intentions, mostly good outcomes, or maybe from all good intentions, we only get good outcomes. So they differ there mildly, but I think they both agree on the basic sort of typology of these three types of relationships. Normatively, they might differ mildly on what they consider favorable, but they both, and this is maybe, right, I'm always, as a historian of economics, interested in the context. I think they both, during the 60s and 70s that they do most of this work, are very convinced that society is moving toward thinking in terms of conflict. And so they both see it as an important role to counter that. And here there's an interesting aspect on Buchanan. Maybe we can expand on that a little bit later. But Buchanan obviously is involved with the public choice program in political economy. And public choice is sort of infamous for telling us that politics is very hard. And a lot of politics is actually a form of predation, of two people agreeing to take some resources away from another and using it for their own good. So these are not mutually beneficial relationships, but zero sum or even negative sum type of relationships. And so they want to move away from that. So I think also in context, I don't say too much here about the context, but I think they see a society that's, I think, also very relevant for today, increasingly thinking of each other as enemies rather than as potential partners or even as friends. And so they want to counter what the dominant type of relationships are in society and what our moral imagination tells us is possible in terms of cooperation and exchange.
That's fascinating. We will return to, I want to say more about several aspects of what you said. One other quick question, which you mentioned at the beginning of your paper, but you only address it briefly. You're talking about, I'll call it speculative. You correct me if I'm understating the claim in the paper. I certainly don't want to overstate it. But towards the beginning, you say, well, how could they have had these similar perspectives? And one of the things you point out in there in passing was that they both came out of the Chicago/Frank Knight tradition, broadly understood. Say something about that, perhaps, if you don't mind.
Well, I wish I could say more. I went into this thinking also because of... I heard more people say this, like, yeah, Balding is a Knight student, but Balding is not a Knight student for very, very long. It's 2 years, it's on and off. It's not a very intimate relationship from what I could gather. But it is interesting that I think both of them are grappling with the role of moral questions in modern social science, which I take to be one of the central tensions. We have a book coming out called Tensions in Frank Knight. And for that, I had a lot of discussions with other Knight scholars. And I take this to be the central tension in Knight, how to reconcile normative considerations with positive modern social science. And unlike the positivists, who sort of say, well, modern social science is only about the positive, Frank Knight sort of agrees with them that science can only really be about the positive. But he is one of those people who sees this as a massive loss, because he says, well, ultimately, the aim is to improve the world, not merely to describe it or to analyze it. And so he doesn't really want to give up that link. And so I see both Buchanan and Balding grappling with that. And I think this is in contrast to what the dominant strand is in post-war Chicago school thinking. which essentially I think takes its cue more from the Milton Friedman setting, is how do we finally get normative considerations out of economics rather than how do we think about the complex relationship between the two?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And just to clarify for listeners, the Tensions book that or volume that Irwin mentioned is part of our Tensions in Thinkers series that we published through the Mercatus Center, and the Tensions in Frank Knight volume will be out, will be published quite soon for those interested. I want to continue down this line of thought, but let's focus on each individual thinker for a moment. Let me ask you a question about each. One of the things you talk about in the paper is this conception that Kenneth Balding has, where he talks about science as a subculture. And I wanted to ask you to expand upon that and talk about it a little more. You got at it, I think, a bit in your opening comments when you linked it to his concept of the image, but I want to ask you to say a little bit more about both of those, science as a subculture and how it connects to his conception of the image.
Yeah, so like I said in the introduction, the image to Balding is shaped by a lot of different factors, and these include essentially all human endeavors. But science, and this is something they take away really, really seriously, I think also from discussions around American pragmatism, is that there's a sort of sense that science is becoming more and more important. Maybe listeners are familiar with Weber's idea that modern science disenchants the world. It gives us a greater degree of control over the world, is what is typically believed. And so this subculture claim is interesting because the subculture argument, I think, says two things. One, it's not marginal. So science has become very, very important, and it occupies a place now next to religion and national cultures in shaping the image, if we just name a couple of big ones. But it also says some other thinkers wanted to replace religion and wanted to replace sort of folk culture or other types of culture, and they are mistaken. So they wildly overestimate both the power and the potential of modern science. So modern science is very important, but it's not all-encompassing, and it cannot sort of overtake these other sources of knowledge. So it's not that all valid knowledge now in the future will come from science, and so our image, to the extent that it still includes religious notions or normative notions that are closer to, cultural history, they are not mere leftovers that will fade away as science progresses, but they will be around forever. And so science sort of complements these other ones. It will have its particular strengths. It might also, we might speak of very scientific or rationalistic cultures in which rely to a great degree on science. But even then, obviously, there's a question on which science do they rely on, right? Do they go for psychology, or do they go for history, or do they go for economics? And so all of those would, I think, lead to somewhat different images of society. And so, yeah, this subculture claim is also in the context, I think, of my broader sort of interest, is a sort of humility claim too. It's science cannot replace the other thing. And this is, again, also a Frank Knight theme, who says science is, again, very, very important, maybe the most important thing we've hit upon ever in human history, but it doesn't give us any answers to normative questions. So it almost poses a new sort of conundrum or a new challenge for us in the sense that we have to reconcile now that it's so powerful, but not all powerful. And so how do we make sense of this? Yeah, I'm tempted to say more, but let me stop there for now.
Let's shift to Buchanan, but we won't lose Balding here. I want to, and you brought this up earlier when you were talking about Buchanan's focus on exchange and how he viewed exchange certainly not just in the context of markets narrowly understood, but also he had this conception of politics as exchange. And I wanted to get your thoughts on how you see that fitting into this conversation, but also Buchanan's conception of the role of the economist in society. Certainly when it came to issues of welfare economics. So of course, I'm thinking about his paper, Positive Economics, Welfare Economics, and Political Economy in the Journal of Law and Economics. He certainly has a very distinct view of how the economist, qua economist, relates to economics as a science, but then also how the economist relates to society, if you will, and more specifically, perhaps I should say democratic society. And so any thoughts on that and how it connects to Balding, or if you just want to focus on Buchanan, that's okay too.
I don't know, because that's up to the readers to judge, but I think my most sort of controversial claim is to say that Buchanan has an argument about the role of the economist in modern society. And I think to Buchanan followers, this is widely accepted. And it's the following, and you reference it in your reference to that paper on positive economics. It's the sort of following. He says, a lot of my fellow economists adopt a technocratic model in which they advise the legislator. And that model, in some sense, right, is agnostic about whether that legislator is a Democrat or democratically elected or is something else. It's also agnostic about exactly what we assume that legislator to have in mind when he is legislating for policy. And so part of Buchanan's critique is, you guys are assuming benevolence there, but what guarantees benevolence? Well, you could say, well, maybe democratic elections secures a degree of benevolence, but he's skeptical of that. And he says, if you truly want to be democratic, don't advise the legislator, advise the citizens. So change your audience. And I think this is widely accepted as a very important critique. He certainly harps on it in his Nobel lecture as one of the key components of what he thinks modern economics gets wrong and what his own program provides a viable alternative for. And so in the paper, I say, well, there's an underappreciated but second way in which Buchanan tried to do something that is maybe not as humble as merely advising citizens, but involves shaping the image that citizens have of themselves and of the world around them and what they can achieve in that. And I think on some level, this is uncontroversial, but a lot of, I think, economists have a long tradition of believing in value freedom, and the way I make the argument, it certainly violates value freedom. But think of the work of the Ostroms that we study a lot. The work of the take-home message for me of the Ostroms is, you guys can do cooperation and collective action solutions quite a bit better than some of your textbooks suggest. So this is a source of hope. And I think for Buchanan too, the argument is, there's a better form of politics possible, a politics that's rooted in exchange relationships, that is not rooted in domination or extractive relationships. And here are some of the first steps in that direction, right? And so I take that to be his sort of second understanding of the public role of economists that exists next to his direct advice to the citizens, right? And now he is not very explicit on this. And here I would have loved to have him be more explicit on this. I think here is where the reconstruction with Balding helps to bring this out more clearly. But I think if we have this goal, we should also be quite explicit about it, because otherwise it starts to sound like we want to nefariously shape the image that people have of the world and just, you know, unconsciously influence them in such a way that they only see one type of solution out there. And that should not at all be it, right? If it's democratic, it's transparent. I think that's a very tight link for a lot of these thinkers. Bob Lucas also famously makes that in his critique of expertise, like, what you guys are doing is not transparent. You're putting a bunch of experts in power. They do juggling tricks behind their back and everything like that, but that's not transparent to the citizens. So also, if talking about the image, I think should have this public aspect of being transparent. And that's what I hope to bring out in this paper, that exists next to the advising citizens role.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, it's interesting, because as you were talking, I was thinking, I mean, Balding, in various places throughout his work, he also has I don't want to say optimism, but it's certainly a message of hope that people can, because in The Image, for instance, he's very explicit about this, that he says something like, the individual is always the owner of the image. So it's not that there's not external, what he calls messages coming at you that can influence you. But at the end of the day, we have agency to varying degrees, of course, to pick and choose what components of those messages we take to heart. And that provides a opening to a whole host of different possibilities.
Yeah, I think in that particular aspect, just very briefly, Boulding's, I think, religious beliefs do shine through. So he also sees, when he comes to analyze the modern organization, right, which is up at that point in time for a lot of critiques, because it's hierarchical, it's massive, it maybe alienates its workers and so on. He says organizations are an important sort of moral exemplar or training ground or whatever you wish. And so when organizations organize themselves, they should be also aware of this role that they have in society, that they too, like modern science, has a sort of cultural role. These modern organizations, because they are such an important part of modern life, have an important role. So he sees that everywhere. And so that's a very consistent through line, I think, in his way of thinking. I'm not sure whether Buchanan would always go there, but yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let me close with a final question and ask you to talk about and reflect on what you see as any present day insights or relevance of what Boulding and Buchanan, despite perhaps their margins of difference, what their conception of the public function of the economist and of economics as a discipline, where do you see relevance today?
Well, I think the first one to me feels like a very obvious one, but one that I think is we simply do not do sufficiently. And that is the following: change your audience. And I think this is a consistent part of Buchanan's argument. Don't advise the policymakers, advise the citizens, but also communicate what your science says broadly so that it can influence the image, right? And especially in a period in the present moment where there's lots of polarization, there's lots of thinking also in, say, foreign relations about, you know, necessarily conflictual relationships, there is an argument to be made that, look, we can work peacefully together. We can live peacefully together. Here are plenty of examples of how that functions in the world. So don't give in to a sort of, it can only be conflict forever and ever until the end of history, sort of view. So the changing audiences is the first one. The second one, and I think this is more contentious, but I think the long-term development of advising governments rather than citizens is that it can lead to distrust, because who will scientists perceive to be on the side of, like, in this view of the state governing over society and scientists for a long time advising the government, right? Sooner or later, the citizens are going to perceive you to be part of the state apparatus or very closely entangled with the state apparatus. And so when they become very critical of the state apparatus, that critique will extend to important parts of modern science. And I think we see some of the fallout from that. And I think it's always sort of dangerous to draw many very deep implications from whatever the present political moment is. But the distrust of elites extends to scientists, because the scientists have persistently identified themselves and addressed themselves to these elites. And so it's not surprising that has become the public perception. So if we are a subculture, and our subculture always exists very close to this other subculture of government experts and of government committees and so on, then obviously that is how we're going to be perceived. It's also a way of understanding where science exists in modern society, and science, I think, exists in a realm that's too often too far away from the citizens and too close to those in power.
I've been speaking with Erwin Decker. The title of his paper is Kenneth Boulding and James Buchanan on the Public Function of Economics. I hope that interested listeners will check out the paper, which has a great amount of detail and insights that go beyond what we were able to cover during our short time today. But Erwin, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Chris. It was very rewarding. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.